I don't believe so. Are you sure it is local?
Honestly, I'm not even sure it exists, Josh said with a shrug. What did he have to go on, other than the obsession of a dead man and the gingerbread trail he'd laid down? The old man joined him at the shelves and started seemingly pulling books down at random, thumbing through the pages to get the indices, musing thoughtfully to himself, then placing it back on the shelf as one after the other let him down. Another came down and went back up. Finally, after maybe 5 minutes of theatre, the bookseller turned to Josh and said,
"Can you perhaps tell me a little more about this place? Perhaps some landmarks or characters? Something else I can try and cross-reference?"
What names did he have? There had been so many in the articles, including, of course, his own family. But one seemed so logically linked to the whole thing, and yet he knew absolutely nothing about the man, beyond the fact that he shared his surname with Glasstown, and Isaiah had described him as the worst of the lot in his letter, whatever that meant. He said,
"Reuben Glass. I don't know much, if anything, about him, save that he would have been around in the 20s, maybe the 30s, and was somehow tied to a stage magician who went by the name of Damiola. Does that help?"
The bookseller shrugged.
"We shall have to see. But that name does ring a bell."
He lifted down a compendium of old Strand magazines from the day, scanning the adverts as well as the articles, until he found what he was looking for. It was a small advert beside similar ones for gentlemen's clothing, but where they promised an array of top hats and tails, this one featured a line drawing of a man, Reuben Glass, who cordially invited people to the opening of the Glass Film House on Latimer Road, where he would be premiering the role that would make Myrna Shepherd one of the most talked-about actresses of the time, raising her up to the pantheon of silent stars that included the stunning beauty of Louise Brooks and Greta Garbo, the flower girl of Belgravia. Any link between Glass and the actress, even one as intangible as this, was enough to prove he was onto something, wasn't it? Could the Glass Film House be the same old cinema that lay in ruins behind the Scala? The derelict building was on Latimer Road.
"Between Notting Hill and Wormwood Scrubs lies a vast desert of human dwellings."
"Sorry?"
"That was how Horace Newt once described Latimer Road," the bookseller said. "A vast desert of human dwellings paints a vivid picture of early 20th century working-class life in the city, don't you think?"
Josh had no idea who Horace Newt was, but he couldn't argue. His few carefully chosen words painted a particular vivid description of the squalor that must have been the city back then. The bookseller took down another book, this one called simply The London That Never Was, The Crime of the Century, and thumbed through the pages until he found what he was looking for.
"Here we are," he said. "Mr. Glass was new money. He had a dream of creating a Hollywood in London a decade before J. Arthur Rank laid the first bricks of Pinewood."
He broke away from reading to opine.
"He was murdered, you know. Quite the scandal."
Now the man had Josh's attention. "I didn't know."
"Yes, here we are."
He stopped turning the pages.
"There were a few books about it back in the day. This one only offers a brief summary, but has, I believe, all of the salient facts. There was talk of Hitchcock adapting one of the more famous accounts, given the salacious nature of the scandal, but obviously that never came to pass. Now I come to think of it, Glasstown might have been the name he'd suggested for his movie studio, a rough play on Hollywood, but I wouldn't like to stake my life on it. There was a global economic crash, which halted the development of the entire film industry. You must remember it was just a fledgling industry at the time, and massive risk was involved, even if people were flocking to gaze adoringly at Valentino and Garbo up on the silver screen. Glass lost a not-so-small fortune trying to build his studio,
money he had raised by drawing loans and favours from one of the oldest criminal families of the East End. I'm trying to recall... Yes, here we are. Lockwood. That was the family. Thoroughly nasty souls. Of course, nothing could ever be proven. When Glass was burned alive, there was talk that the killing was a falling out among thieves. They found traces of silver nitrate residue on his corpse, believed to be a mocking reference to his failed endeavour, silver nitrate being an essential part of the filmmaking process back then.
"So Glasstown got him killed," Josh said, his mind racing.
"I suppose you could say that," the bookseller nodded. "Fascinating case, all things considered. One of the first real gangland stories of our city. Of course, it's all but forgotten now in the shadow of the craze."
"How about the stage magician, Damiola?"
"Other than you just mentioning it, I can't say the name rings any bells. But then I've never been a great follower of celebrity. But if he's of note, then perhaps there'll be something in here."
He pulled down another book, this one seemingly a history of London theatre, and easily as old as the bookseller himself, and began leafing through it.
"Ah, here we are. Cadmus Damiola. I do believe we found the fellow. Who needs the internet, eh? So let's see what history has got to say about him, shall we?"
The bookseller thumbed back through the pages to those referenced in the index and started to read.
"After delighting the crowds of the capital for 18 months with his wondrous Opticron, a curious contraption that ostensibly allowed viewers to spy other worlds through its many lenses, the magician confounded fans and critics alike by walking away from the spotlight. Fated by none other than Harry Houdini himself, Damiola gave his final performance on the evening of Saturday, 12 January, 1924, in the Adelphi Theatre on the Strand, never to be seen again. The show had been booked to run for 3 more weeks, but all subsequent performances were cancelled. Rumours abounded at the time that he had fallen foul of key figures in the East End underworld, and that his disappearance may not have been entirely voluntary. A body, believed to be his, was found some 5 years later, and interred at Ravenshill Cemetery in East London. All of his tricks, mechanisms, journals, and paraphernalia of his act, bar the Opticron that made his name, were donated to the Magic Circle by his heirs."
The bookseller tuttered and closed the book.
"Well, well, well. Quite the character, wouldn't you say? It does make you wonder if they may not be the same hoodlums who gave Glass such a hard time, doesn't it?"
Josh wasn't about to say what he thought, but it would seem to be linked, at least on the surface. Damiola's final curtain call was the night before Eleanor Raines disappeared. Glass was in Lockwood's debt, the magician in his pocket. At every turn he kept coming up against the spectre of Seth Lockwood and his hateful family. It had gone far beyond the realms of coincidence. They tried some of the other names, including Seth and Isaiah, but had no joy. As an afterthought, he asked the man, "Does the word Anwin mean anything to you?"
"Why, yes, it most certainly does. It is one of the many names they used to give to the druidic underworld during the age of the Celts."
"Underworld? Like hell?"
"And Hades, and the others, indeed one and the same. It was ruled by Aron, the horned god, who himself is the root of the once-and-future king legend we associate with the mythical Arthur."
Josh had no idea why Boone had noted the name Anwin, not once but twice, or how it related to the disappearance of Eleanor Raines. But the old man must have written it down for a reason, along with all of those mythological references on the third wall. He'd just have to keep chasing until he could make sense of it all. Boone had had a lifetime with this stuff, after all. He couldn't expect to unravel it all in a night. He asked about the cemetery, as it wasn't one he was familiar with.
"Gone.
the bookseller explained.
Lost in the Blitz. I'm not entirely sure what's left beyond a marker stone and a broken gateway. Maybe a few of the old stones. It's not far from here, in the shadow of the tower.
He hooked a thumb back over his shoulder, indicating the city's most famous landmark.
Which is, of course, where it drew its name, right on the old wall where the city proper ends and the east end begins.
The bookseller invited Josh to share a snifter, in the hopes that he would tell him more about his interest in Damiola, Reuben Glass, his cinematic studio Glasstown, and the gangsters in Josh's family tree. But Josh wanted to visit some of the other places on his map before dark. Not that he expected to find Glasstown, which, if he was being brutally honest with himself, he doubted existed outside of a dead man's increasingly desperate obsession and another dead man's foolish dream. But it was a mystery, and there weren't enough mysteries in the world anymore. That, and it was his legacy. Boone had wanted him to have Isaiah's letter, which surely meant that Boone had wanted him to carry on looking for Eleanor. He loved his grandfather, so how could he deny him his final wish? He couldn't, obviously. But there was a huge difference between taking a few days and dedicating the rest of his life to something. He wasn't Isaiah. This wasn't his story. Isaiah had never stopped looking for the woman he loved. He'd become so fixated on her disappearance, he'd broken away from his own family, turned his back on his own brother, married his sister, and taken her name as he disappeared down the rabbit hole of his obsession. And then he'd passed it on through the family, like some kind of perverse inheritance, until it had found its way to his great-grandson. Josh wasn't going to let it claim his life. He'd give it another day, walk around the remaining sites on the map, chalk them off one by one, and if he didn't miraculously stumble upon the secrets of Glasstown and Damiola's trickery, then at least he'd tried, right? Couldn't say fairer than that. He spent 5 hours wandering the streets around Aldgate, Spitalfields and Shadwell, pushing through suits rushing to and from meetings, looking at the cracks in the pavement and the clothes the pedestrians wore, trying to see if he could pick out anything that looked obviously out of time. It was next to impossible, because London was a city entirely built around eclecticism and the aesthetics of dozens of cultures and time periods, with fashion ranging from the Baroque and steampunkish to the plain old punk by way of burkas and band t-shirts and everything else imaginable. Kids wandered by in furry costumes with animal ears. No one walked around with a sign that said, "I just stepped out of 1924. And no matter how intently he stared at the cracks in the pavement or peered around the corners of buildings, he didn't once catch a glimpse of another world. One by one he chalked off the sights with no more joy than the last, and none of them seemed to have anything in common with any of the others. A bar, a bookies, an abandoned church on a street corner, its steeple missing a dozen slates, an old movie theater that had died when the multiplexes came, a supermarket, a trendy clothes store, a second-hand record shop with its shutters rolled down, a cafe called Paper Cups, a block of masonettes, the gates of a Jewish cemetery, the courtyard of a disused hospital that was in the process of being converted to luxury little pied-à-terre, and a payday loan place, the modern version of the pawnbrokers, the stylized checkbook of its logo hanging out over the pavement. Some of them were abandoned, some quite obviously repurposed from whatever they might have been in another life, while a couple were untouched from the 20s, but there was no rhyme or reason to why Boone had marked them out. He looked on the walls for a sign, a small tag of graffiti, or something that would imply a link between the sites. But whilst there was plenty of creative street art on display at some of the sites, the others were painfully bland. He looked for scratches or markings in the flagstones of the floor, remembering what his mum had always said about stepping on the cracks, breaking your mum's back. He looked for anything vaguely cinematic, thinking that maybe that was the link. Nothing, or rather plenty of things. He was in a city full of them, but none of them offered some readily apparent red thread, running through them like the room back at Boone's secret place. As the day wore on, It grew more and more frustrating, feeling like he'd taken one step forward at the bookstore and two steps back since leaving it. Josh browsed through the racks in the trendy clothes shop, feeling very much out of place in his slept-in funeral suit. He walked through the Jewish cemetery, marveling at how the gravestones were packed in one upon another, like a crazy game of Dead Man Tetris to fill every available space, and listened to a tour guide explain how they'd buried the dead vertically instead of horizontally, to make the most of the expensive real estate. It was practical, if nothing else. He stopped for an overpriced latte in the cafe, and posed as a potential buyer to walk around the hospital grounds. Nothing. Even though it wasn't on his map, Josh went to Spitalfields Market and walked the perimeter, looking down every alleyway and each narrow street around Brick Lane and thereabouts, purely because Isaiah had thought he'd seen Eleanor there. He saw more of London that afternoon and early evening than he would normally see of it in a month. But not once did he notice anything to suggest that Glasstown was anything more than an old man's obsession, whatever it might have been once. After a while it began to feel like he was going slightly mad. At one point he thought he caught a glimpse of a couple dressed as Crake and Clamp, probably on their way to a costume party. They certainly looked the part. But other than that, London presented him with its most mundane face. The most excitement he got was when a couple of spiky-haired girls ran past singing Duran Duran's Union of the Snake, before disappearing hand in hand into a sex store on the fringe of Soho. It was dusk. The offices turned out for the night. He didn't want to be seen by anyone he knew from work. Josh finally admitted defeat. He wasn't going to miraculously stumble into the lost world of Reuben Glass's cinematic ambition. Hungry, he ducked into a not-so-greasy spoon and ordered himself an all W11-day breakfast, which really was stretching the limits of the definition of all day, taking it into the night. He perched on one of the high window stools to wait for it, and stared out into space. The rain, which had been on and off all afternoon, turned into a proper downpour. Water rushed down the gutter, filling the drains faster than they could carry it away. A couple of people rushed by, heads down, while a woman walked more sedately through the rain, an umbrella obscuring her face. She wore heels and stockings with a seam so straight it must have been drawn in. It was only because he was staring at her legs that he saw the newspaper headline on the side of the kiosk. Another fine mess as comedians rob Magic Circle. He couldn't help but grin, and would have gone to grab a paper, but the vendor was long gone. He craned his neck trying to see the woman with the straight seams, but her brisk stride had carried her out of sight. With nothing to do but wait, Josh thought about calling home to check in with Lexi. But as he fished his phone out of his pocket, he saw that it was dead, so that killed that idea. A few minutes later, the waitress brought over a chipped white cup and poured a strong black coffee into it. He thanked her and continued to gaze into the middle distance, watching the world go by. He was out of ideas. So much for solving a mystery that had haunted his family for generations, with one day's legwork hoofing it around London like some half-assed Indiana Jones. He smiled wryly at the arrogance of youth. Eventually the food came, swimming in tomato sauce. Two fried eggs over greasy Cumberland sausage, rashers of bacon, button mushrooms, and hash browns to soak it all up. It tasted exactly how a fry-up was meant to taste, and starving, Josh wolfed it down like a death row prisoner, knowing there'd be no last-minute reprieve. So intent was he upon the feast, he didn't realize the woman had returned and was watching him from the street corner. 19. Eleanor. Eleanor Rain stood on the street corner as long as she dared, looking like the tragic central focus in a melancholic painting of the city in the rain. He looked so much like Isaiah sitting there, framed by the window and the streaks of rain running down its glass. So very, very much like him. It was uncanny. For a moment she caught herself thinking that it might actually be him, that somehow he'd found a way to cling on to time without the need of the illusionist's prison. But the longer she watched him, the more she became sure he wasn't the man she'd loved and lost, for all that he looked so very like him. They could so easily have come from the same soul split in two. He was different. The way he brushed the lock of hair out of his eyes so he could see the food. That he was left-handed when he ate, not right. That he touched his temple when he was thinking, massaging it counterclockwise. He was narrower across the shoulder and broader across the smile as he thanked the waitress for the refill. But more than anything, he seemed content inside his own skin, happy enough to eat alone without needing to engage with the world around him. She liked that about him. Was that how Isaiah would have been if he'd been allowed to grow up normally? She leaned back against the wall, angling the umbrella to better see the man in the cafe window. He cradled his cup, gazing out into the Middle Kingdoms. How could he be anything other than Isaiah's kin? Just look at him. Of course, it wasn't the first time she'd seen him. Eleanor had watched him outside of the church yesterday as they buried Isaiah's boy. That was hard, not walking up to him before he walked inside and just holding him and pretending he was someone he wasn't, sharing his grief. But she'd had no business being there, so she turned to go without saying a word, only to see Seth leading his own son through the wooden lych gate into the graveyard. Without thinking, she ran. She ran hard and fast, stumbling on her heels and having to grab a stranger to stop from falling in her panic. As he tried to help her, she pushed away from him and ran on, knowing she was drawing attention to herself even as she did it. She couldn't risk Seth seeing her. He didn't know she was here, back in London. He didn't know she'd found a way to slip between the cracks and escape her prison, if only for a few hours at a time. That snatched freedom was the most precious thing in her life. He could never know about it. Never. But the boy had come looking for her, hadn't he? Even though he hadn't seen her, and she didn't know his name, he was trying to find her. Like father, like son, and now like great-grandson. Maybe he'd be the one. That was the only explanation for his tour today. He'd taken in all of the anchors, even if he didn't know what he was looking for, or how close he had been to stumbling up it. One, even two, might have been chance, but not all 13 of them. He was following Damiola's pathway, even if he didn't know it. Which meant he knew about Glasstown, and that, in turn, meant he knew about her. So there was hope, wasn't there? Hope that he would be the one who finally freed her for more than an hour or two from that hell of Damiola's making. Hope that one day it would finally be over. The bitter truth was that Hope was a bastard that wouldn't leave her alone to die. She would have been better off without it. She looked at her distant reflection, knowing even as she did that it was aging faster than anything around her, time desperately trying to catch up with her flesh. She couldn't stay out here much longer, even a few minutes more out here breathing the air of the 21st century, drinking in the life that had outpaced her, surrounded by all of these things she barely understood and had no place being among, and there'd be no arresting its merciless assault on her flesh. And no hiding it from Seth. He wasn't a fool. He'd know what fresh wrinkles meant. And would that be such a bad thing, to simply wither away and finally die? Eleanor wondered. There was a limit to how long she could stay in the city before time and life caught up with her. She could feel it now, tightening her skin, drying it out and stretching it across her old bones. One day, maybe even one day soon, she'd stay out here and let it take her. It was tempting, the idea that it would all finally be over. But not today. No matter how much she hated her life, no matter how much of a prisoner she was to it, to Damiola and Lockwood and that bastard Glass, it was still her life, and she couldn't surrender it while there was still hope it might be saved, even if that hope had tomato sauce on his chin. Using her lipstick, she wrote a message for him on the wall, and hoped he would find it. 20. Lost Girl. Josh cleaned his plate and set the knife and fork down at a slight angle on it. It always made him smile, but there was no getting around the little habits that were ingrained in him, thanks to years growing up with Boone. There were proper ways to do things, like setting your knife and fork down together at 5:25 on the clock face of the plate. The weather had worsened over the last 30 minutes. London looked particularly sodden, but then the city was getting used to flooding. Well, vacillating between flood and drought, to be more factually accurate, and had been for the last few years. The weather reports were filled with freak floods, freak snows, freak hailstorms with hailstones the size of golf balls, and stock footage of people sandbagging their doors and canoeing down the middle of what had been the road. The rain never seemed to drain away, meaning every year the water table rose a little higher, meaning every year the streets flooded a little faster than the last, as though Mother London was trying to wash away her sins. Even the Thames Barrier, the last great defense against the elements, built to save the city from flooding, was next to useless as the water table had essentially risen above its protections in the few short years since its completion. A kid hunched over the curb, making a paper boat out of a nightclub flyer to set sail down the gutter, as a black cab aquaplaned around the corner, soaking her. Unperturbed, the kid scrambled forward on her hands and knees and launched her paper boat in the taxi's wake. The little boat was stubborn. Josh looked up from the girl and saw red writing on the wall that he knew hadn't been there 10 minutes ago. He couldn't read it from where he was, and the rain was already making it run. He pushed himself out of his seat and hurried out of the door and across the street, nearly getting himself run over in the process. The driver yelled something at him out of his window. He wasn't listening. He stared at the wall, and then grabbed the kid, who wriggled like a lizard in a tin trying to break free of his grasp.
"Did you see who wrote this?"
"Get your hands off me, you fucking perv!"
Only it sounded like fackin' when she said it.
"You want you tree chasing you?"
"Did you see who wrote this?"
Josh asked again, ignoring her protests, and twisting her around so that she could see the two red words dripping like blood down the wall. "Find me."
"I didn't see nothing,"
the girl grumbled, but he refused to let her squirm away.
"And I'm serious about you, Tree, so get your hands off me, mister."
"So you saw something,"
Josh said, turning the double negative around.
"What? I just said I didn't see nothing. You stupid."
"Forget it,"
he said, letting go of her collar. She went sprawling across the pavement, and then looked up at him like he'd completely betrayed her, by actually letting her go like she'd asked him to.
"She went that way."
The girl nodded down the street, toward the huge market hall filled with designer foods, packaged up at designer prices.
"What did she look like? What was she wearing?"
The girl shook her head.
"Dunno. Pretty. Long coat. I couldn't see her face because of the umbrella."
"Think, please. Anything you can remember that might help."
The girl sat there on the wet paving slabs, looking up at him as she made a show of thinking.
"Long yellow coat, red umbrella."
He'd seen her, he realized. Not only had he seen her, he'd sat there admiring her legs, or rather the impossibly straight black seams of her stockings. It had to be her.
"Thank you."
Josh started to run in the direction the girl had indicated, the soles of his shoes slapping on the wet paving slabs. The pavement was slick and slippery. He twisted and dodged around a couple of pedestrians, shuffling along like the walking dead, and reached the corner, looking left and right. The downpour intensified, the rain spiking up 6 inches off the road around him. He couldn't hear for the drumming and the whistle of the wind as it howled through the high buildings, rattling window panes and loose tiles. It was like staring out into a gale. But there she was, a couple of 100 yards away, about to disappear around another corner. It had to be her, and if he let her walk around that corner, he knew he'd be letting her walk out of his life just like that. So the rain could pour and the wind could howl. He wasn't slowing down or stopping. He ran faster, gritting his teeth and calling,
"Wait!"
after her. But his words were drowned out by the rain. She didn't slow down. She didn't look back. She walked into the heart of the storm, even as it whipped up into a righteous fury. The ferocity of it and the speed it came on was frightening. It was as if the elements were trying to keep them apart, the universe conspiring to keep its secrets. Josh kept his head down and fought his way across the road, following her onto a narrower street. The tarmac changed into cobblestones halfway down the street. He looked up, trying to see her. The rain streamed down his face. He wiped it away, but it didn't matter how much he rubbed at his face, it kept getting in his eyes, stinging and blurring his vision, and making it impossible to focus as it tried to drive his head down. There were no shops on this street. Gone were the lunch restaurants and designer delis. Gone were the second-hand stores and the florists and the offices. He stumbled into what quite literally felt like another world. A Victorian slice of London that must surely have been unchanged since the time of the Good Queen herself, and more aptly, since the days of Number 13. The cobbles were worn smooth, and there was no white line down the middle of the road. If he'd reached out, he could have touched the buildings on either side of him as he ran down the middle of the street. It was that claustrophobic. There were fewer people here, but the street felt twice as crowded because it was so narrow. The second story of the nearest buildings loomed in over him, casting deep shadows across the street as it narrowed yet again, until it felt no wider than his shoulders.
"Wait, please!"
Josh called. She heard him this time, and visibly hesitated before she threw a backward glance over her shoulder. Despite the misstep, she didn't slow down for more than a fraction of a second. She didn't need to, because Josh stopped dead in his tracks. They were less than 100 yards apart. He recognized her. Even with the rain in his eyes and the wind making it difficult to focus for more than a moment at a time. How could he not? She was the reason he was out here in the first place. She was the reason his great-grandfather had lost his mind, and the reason Boone had lived a secret life all those years. She was the woman who hadn't aged a day in 90 years. She was Eleanor Raines. And she really was beautiful. Not what they called beautiful in those glossy adverts and magazines he sold. Beautiful in a truer, purer sense of the word. Not all sharp angles and shadows and heroin chic. None of the pictures plastered on the bedroom wall did her justice, he realized, and knew he was standing there gaping like a fool. The reality of Eleanor Raines made every photograph seem flat, dull, and lifeless. In that moment, he could see why Isaiah had refused to just let her go.
"Eleanor!"
he called, taking a step forward, knowing his voice wouldn't carry. He didn't want to shout for fear of breaking the moment.
"Wait!"
She turned away, breaking it for him, and carried on down the alleyway. The sound of her high heels clicking on the cobblestones was lost beneath the rain. She ducked down an even narrower passage, this one more like a shadowy crack between two buildings than a footpath.
"Wait!"
he called again, chasing her to the mouth of the empty alleyway.
"Please!"
He could hear something. Children laughing. No, not that. Birds, starlings. He looked up and saw a vast flock of them banking on the fringes of the storm, the flock spiraling overhead tighter and tighter, until their wingtips touched and they looked like a vortex in the sky, their black bodies the eye of the storm itself, casting a shadow over the streets below. When he looked back down, there was no sign of Eleanor Raines, and nowhere she could have gone. No doors into the buildings that started the alleyway. No gates in the high wooden fences that continued it. He was alone. It was as though she'd slipped between the cracks and simply disappeared right before his eyes. 21. Raven's Hill. He turned over every stone in the alley, physical and metaphorical, but she simply wasn't there, and there was nowhere she could have gone. Part of Josh began to doubt she'd ever been there, that he'd caught whatever sickness had driven the rest of the men in his family, all save for his dad, Barclay Raines, who died well before his time, and in that case, probably before the obsession could take hold, mad. With no real idea what else to do, Josh followed the only clue he had left, and embarked upon a pilgrimage of the dead. It was that or give up and go home for the night, and going home meant facing Lexi and his mum, and work in the morning, which felt too much like the real world for today. Today was the kind of day meant for creating his own Josh stories his friends could trade with smiles at his memorial. He knew roughly where the old Ravenshill burial grounds were supposed to be, if not where they actually were, thanks to the ever-shifting landscape of the city. One thing he'd already learned was that a lot could change in 90 years, not least the contents of a cemetery in London, which wasn't something he would ever have imagined before the bookseller's explanation, and then of course it had made absolute sense. The Blitz had rewritten the landscape, and it stood to reason that the bombs wouldn't discriminate between the living and the dead. He had no idea what, if anything, he'd find waiting for him at the end of his pilgrimage. Graffiti on the walls offered the wisdom of a generation's worth of prophets. They didn't have very much to say, or maybe it was just a case of being too old to understand what they were saying. Wasn't that how it worked? Each generation had its own idols and martyrs, and where once it had been Timothy Leary, now it was the Steve Jobs of the world, or whichever faceless suit had replaced his vision after cancer had claimed him, the youth bowed down to, as they offered every sort of iGenius for download by the kilobyte if you had the right data package. The city moved to the drumbeat of its heart, an insistent percussion that had Josh looking back over his shoulder on every street corner, not just looking left and right before crossing the road. She had been there, almost close enough to reach out and touch. He thought about Isaiah's confession to Boone that he'd seen her, unchanged, in 1994, and realized that as crazy as it was true. That was a game-changer. It was one thing to keep it all at a distance and think of it almost academically, but it was quite another when it was the evidence of your own eyes. Eleanor Raines might have disappeared 90 years ago, but she had been here less than an hour ago, as though she'd stepped out of one timeline and into another. Josh sank down onto a bench seat, head in hands, ignoring the rain, and tried to think it through, but there was nothing about it that made sense. The whole impossible scenario defied logical explanation. But there was no getting away from the fact that he'd seen what he'd seen. She'd been running. From him. From Lockwood's goons. There were so many places someone could lurk unseen. The streets were nothing more than an elaborate rat trap. Unwelcome Boomtown Rats lyrics ran through Josh's mind, as he doubled back on himself, determined not to be caught. He glimpsed his reflection in a shop window. He looked harried, tired, and stretched thin. He couldn't be sure that was entirely an illusion of the glass. He checked the street signs against the basic map of the city he'd used to mark out the strange scorch marks on the wooden floor of Boone's secret flat, following its landmarks to be sure he was walking the right way. Up ahead, he saw the gates of the burial ground, as the bookseller had promised, and for a moment thought the pitted iron was all that remained of the cemetery, because behind them rose gleaming towers of concrete and steel, reflecting dozens of incarnations of London back through their blind windows. He saw a little old man huddled up on a bench, oblivious to the rain. The man, with the wisps of his white hair plastered flat to his scalp, looked up at him as he approached the wrought iron gates. The iron formed the black wings of a raven, reinforcing the dilapidated cemetery's name. One side of the gates hung lopsided, only held in place by the rust. As he got closer, he realized that the old man was actually a tramp, swaddled in layer upon layer of dirty old coats and torn trousers. He wore a pair of hobnail boots that had been resold so many times you could tell the age of them by looking at the rings around the bottom of them. The smell was the worst of it. Weeks-old piss, fused into his coats, was being released by the rain. The old man nodded as he passed. He had the red vines of alcohol abuse across his cheeks, and the telltale open bottle peeking out of one of his pockets as he leaned forward, watching Josh every step of the way. The guy was creepy, but said nothing, and made no move to stop Josh or beg for spare change to waste on the demon drink. Josh ignored his audience and walked through the gates, passing into a lost part of London. It wasn't miraculous. Crossing the threshold didn't suddenly transport him to Oz or Narnia. It didn't block out the sounds of the traffic or life on the other side, but it might as well have, because Ravenshill was a different country. Josh let his feet take him down the overgrown path between the headstones, looking for Damiola's name on one of them. A tree to his left was ringed by crooked stones. There must have been 200 headstones crammed together with only inches between them. None of their engravings were visible, the names of the dead lost. Moss and lichen clung to the weathered stone. There were no bodies beneath the stones. They had been destroyed during the bombings. The stone circle was all that remained of 200 lost souls. Time was the cemetery's worst enemy. It encroached everywhere. Its fingers wormed their way into every nook and cranny, filling them with natural signs of decay. The old stones could stand against anything apart from time. Josh walked through the lines of graves. There were no mourners here, and no signs of fresh flowers on any of the plots to suggest that any might come. It was hardly surprising, given the fact that the last interment had happened some 60 years ago. Other than the tramp guarding the gates, there was no one left to mourn these dead. Beneath the weeping willows, he saw an ancient mausoleum fenced off by iron railings. It was overlooked by two stone angels, the skeletal limbs of overhanging trees and the hungry roots of vegetation gone to seed reclaimed the structures on either side of the mausoleum. It wouldn't be too many years before they claimed it for their own. They were already creeping through the black railings. Crooked gravestones marked more of the nameless dead, their memorials weathered away. The place gave Josh the creeps. He was just about to give up any hope of finding Damiola's resting place amid the ranks of anonymous stones, fearing the worst, that it was somewhere amid those ringing the tree, when he saw the mausoleum gates properly for the first time, realizing that the filigreed metal looked like a magician's gloves, caught in the moment of transformation from cloth to blackbird ready to fly. He'd found Cadmus Damiola's tomb. A deep crack ran through the wall where clematis vine had clawed it open. The gate was locked, but judging by the state of the rust-eaten hinges, it wasn't going to provide any sort of obstacle. Josh looked around to be sure that he wasn't being watched. The tramp had left his bench and wandered off, and then boosted himself up, scrambling over the railings with their blunted spear-tip points. He dropped down on the other side and stayed in the crouch, looking around again for prying eyes. He couldn't have looked more suspicious if he'd been carrying a hand-painted placard that declared he was a tomb robber. Satisfied he was alone, Josh crossed the short distance to the iron-studded crypt door, which, like the gate, was locked. He hadn't thought this far ahead. The lock itself was more decorative than practical, the keyhole as big as his fist. He could see part of the mechanism through the keyhole, but without something to trip it, he wasn't getting inside. It was ironic, of course. After all the years Boone had worked so hard to keep him from becoming one of the Rothery kids, and here he was contemplating breaking into somewhere far more sacred than any two up, two down, because of the old man's obsession. It was contagious. His great-grandfather's madness had been handed down to him like some twisted heirloom. Seeing Eleanor had just cemented it for him. He couldn't not open the door after that. He owed it to her, to Isaiah, and ultimately to Boone. He needed something thin enough and strong enough to work into the hole and turn the heavy tumbler without breaking and blocking the mechanism, assuming the tumbler wasn't jammed up with the rust of age. None of his keys were long enough to do the job. The answer was entwined in the elaborate iron gloves of the rusted gate. It took him a few minutes to worry free one of the thinner pieces of filigreed iron from the design, the rust flaking off in his hands and staining them a dull red as he did so. but he had what he needed, a makeshift lockpick. A few seconds later, Josh heard the satisfying clunk of the tumbler falling into place. He took a deep breath, then pushed the door open. The other side was absolutely dark, broken only by the shaft of faint light that encroached around him. Josh stepped inside. He hadn't thought to bring a torch, and with his phone dead, the only light source he had was Boone's old petrol lighter. He took the battered tin from his coat's deep pocket and rescued the lighter from inside. He slipped the tin back into his pocket and wrapped his hand around the lighter. A short flight of 9 stairs led down to a second set of double doors. Even in the Stygian gloom, he could just make out the accoutrement of the stage magician's craft carved into them. The doors were exquisite, a work of art that, like the tomb itself, spoke of surprising wealth, which jarred against the expectation of a man who had spent his life treading the boards of British theatres, offering penny entertainments for the masses. How could he have accumulated the kind of fortune such an afterlife demanded? There was only one answer to that, of course. Lockwood. It was the logical leap as far as joining the dots of what had started out as a very cold missing persons case, and was beginning to look like a grand criminal conspiracy that went back a century. Damiola had been in Lockwood's pocket, either through greed or fear, both great motivators on their own, but together surely irresistible. Josh approached the door, resting the flat of his hand against the shape of a huge leafless tree and the curious Celtic knotwork carved into the door. He opened the door. 22. The Mysteries of Damiola.
"There are no answers in there,"
a voice said behind him, scaring a month of his allotted years out of Josh with those 6 softly spoken words.
"At least not the ones you are looking for."
Josh's heart was in his throat as he turned to see the old tramp silhouetted against the entrance. He was taller than he'd realized, close to 6 foot, and despite the thick layers of coats padding his bulk up, he was skeletally thin and showing obvious signs of malnutrition. His breath stank almost as badly as his damp coats. But even so, there was something about the man, a presence.
"I always knew someone would come looking eventually. I'm surprised it took you so long. Which one are you? You look like Isaiah, but you're not him. His boy?"
Josh shook his head. The tramp had a slight accent, the lingering trace of something he couldn't place.
"Poor bastard. Didn't deserve what was done to him. If I could do anything, I'd change that."
"Who are you?"
"No one anymore. I used to be him."
He pointed over Josh's shoulder toward the doors and the tomb beyond them.
"But now he's just bones, and I'm a ghost, I guess. Or as good as. Funny what time does to you. But I should know that better than anyone. But I'm more interested in who you are, boy, and how you fit into this sorry story. Tell me that."
Josh started to say he wasn't involved, not really. But he'd been actively searching out the truth of Glasstown ever since he'd heard its name. Instead, he said, "Did you know my great-grandfather?"
"Ah,"
the tramp said, inclining his head slightly, piecing together the genetic puzzle, but coming to a conclusion a couple of generations short.
"That explains you wearing his face. Time moves on, always ticking on. Tick, tick, tick. No matter how much we might want to grab a hold of its hands and slow it down to a more manageable pace. On it goes. Tick, tick, tick. Cruel bastard. So, the hunt has passed from one generation to another. You won't find it here, you know. There's no hidden door. Or, to put it another way, You're barking up the wrong burial place if you think coming here will help you get in or get her out. I'll tell you what I told him that night. She's gone. Forget her. I'm good at what I do. Or at least I was. He was.
He looks pointedly toward the doors behind Josh.
Go on. Open the door. Disturb my old bones. There's nothing in there that will help you.
How can you be in there and out here? You keep talking about the body in there as if it's you, like you're some ghostly guardian. Josh wanted to say, but the moonlight isn't streaming through you. You're not some phantom. But he is you, isn't he? Somehow.
Somehow.
The old tramp nodded.
Cadmus Damiola, the less than magnificent, at your service.
The old man said, forgoing any bow or scrape, because his old bones wouldn't allow it. Josh studied him in the flickering petrol light, trying to peel away the layers of grime and time to get to the face the tramp had once owned. Despite the trickery of the shadows, he was sure he'd seen it before, or a version of it, on the poster announcing Damiola's grand tour on the wall in Boone's Rotherhithe flat, which meant the old tramp was telling the truth, or at least a version of it, because that would have made him 120 years old, give or take a few rotations around the sun, and he was looking pretty damn sprightly for someone who'd lived the best part of two lifetimes.
Go on, open the door if you don't believe me. Perhaps I'm lying. And enlightenment waits within.
How long have you been standing guard out there?
Longer than I thought, he said.
Josh didn't say anything, struggling to come to terms with the idea that the stage magician spent his days at the gates of the destroyed cemetery, guarding his own tomb. Why would anyone do that? The lighter burned hot in his hand. There was only so long he'd be able to hold on to it, before he had to flip the lid closed and plunge himself back into the pitch-black darkness of the tomb. He made a decision, then, turning his back on the tramp and stepped up to the door. As he reached out for the huge brass ring handle, he half expected Cadmus Damiola to say that only the worthy shall cross the threshold, and he had been deemed unworthy. He didn't. Instead, the old tramp said,
"It is good that you don't trust what you've been told. Words are so often the basis for any misdirection. Look at my hands. See? Nothing up my sleeve. Nothing hidden in them. But what's this? Is that your card? It is. I don't believe it."
He smiled wryly, his tone mimicking the wide-eyed amazement of the spectator seeing the magic for the first time.
"Don't you think if it was that easy to uncover the secrets of my greatest illusion of my life, any of the many who have come looking before you would have found my secrets long ago? I mean, ask yourself this. How hard was it for you to find this place, truly?"
Josh flipped the lid closed on the lighter, giving the metal case a chance to cool down. He twisted the brass ring and pushed, but the door didn't budge an inch.
"Oh, well, would you look at that," the old tramp muttered. "Maybe the hinges have rusted. You might want to give it a really good shove. Maybe that'll do the trick. Really put your shoulder into it."
Josh knew he was being played with. Even so, he twisted the brass ring again, feeling the tooth of the hidden mechanism retract, and pushed hard, but the doors didn't give.
"Curious. Perhaps something is blocking the way. Let me try for you."
Josh moved aside as the old man shuffled forward, placing the flat of his hand on the black wood. As he did so, the sigils carved into the wood flared, as if aflame for a second, the fire chasing through the crevices carved into the door to bring the patterns to brief, fiery life. For the silence between two heartbeats, The dark passage was lit an angry red, and then plunged back into darkness as Cadmus Damiola opened the door. The sudden intensity of the light stung his eyes.
No, everything seems to be fine. After you. But don't say I didn't warn you. I promise you, it is quite the anticlimax. And I should know, given I've been the sole occupant since 1929. At some point, I really should go back and die, I suppose. Come to think of it, you might want some light, save you from burning your fingers on that old Zippo of yours.
The old tramp clicked his fingers, and in response, a stub of candle in the brass holder on the sarcophagus in the center of the room came alive, lighting up the crypt with a sizzle of sulfate. It was a single flame, but more than enough to light the entire tomb.
I knew you'd come. You or someone like you. Ever since I felt the first of the Duomas failing, I knew it was only a matter of time until someone turned up at my grave. I thought it would be Seth, ordering me to restore the magic, to make it whole again, banish that place back to hell. Or Isaiah, begging me to rip apart the veil once and forever. So much time has passed, so many years. I don't know how it could ever come to this, but it must be inevitable, because here you are, and here I am, and I know what you are about to ask me. But first, let me ask you, why should I help you?
He didn't have an answer for that.
How do I know you aren't one of them?
2 days ago, I knew nothing about anything. My biggest concern was that I'd screwed up my grandfather's eulogy, Josh said. And then I find a house filled with my family's obsession. Articles, photographs, film reels, all of them about Eleanor Raines. At that, the old man stiffened.
Did you release the reels? Was that you I heard?
Did I what? I have no idea what that means. No, I don't think so. I watched a few minutes of an uncut Hitchcock movie filmed in Rotherhithe. Is that what you mean?
No, the old man said. But if it wasn't you, you have an enemy here.
Seth, Josh said. The question is, do I have a friend here? The old man craned his head as though listening to voices in the wind only he could hear.
Yes, for now. As long as you stand against Seth.
Josh entered the cramped tomb, the tramp a couple of steps behind him. The old man was right and wrong at the same time. Everything beyond the threshold was disappointing and extraordinary at the same time. The light flickered, guttering in the breeze as it chased into the small space, but didn't go out. The candlelight pushed the shadows away from the sarcophagus. Josh didn't realize what was happening at first, barely noticing the way the shadows on the far wall had begun to take on some sort of shape. But as the flame settled down, so too did the shadows, and their nature became clear. They were a map of sorts.
My original designs for Glasstown, the old man said. My greatest trick, and yet the only one I have never been in a position to take a bow for. It will be nice for someone to appreciate the brilliance of it, even if only for a short while. Sadly for you, there is no way Lockwood will let you live now that you have got this close. You do know that, don't you?
13 stones on the walls were deep red in color, almost as though stained with blood. Josh didn't need to check his own map to know that they coincided with the 13 points scorched into the floor of the Rotherhithe flat and copied down there. Josh looked from him to the sarcophagus and back again. Beyond the shadows and the stone tomb, there was nothing else in the crypt.
How can you be in there and out here? It doesn't make sense. Not that any of this makes sense.
It's a long story, including more than a little alcohol, desperation, a pretty girl, and a necromancer. But then aren't they all?
The best usually are, Josh agreed, as though there was nothing remotely extraordinary about the fact the old tramp's non-explanation included the word necromancer.